I think it'd be useful perhaps to begin by asking the question, why should we be interested in Marx? Why did I think it might be a useful contribution to talk a bit about Marx? Marx, after all, is a declared atheist. Marx is really an enemy of the church, is he not? Wasn't Marx the one who declared that religion was the opiate of the people? Hasn't Marx really suggested that the church and much of what we at Holden Village believe in is really the enemy? Isn't he, you know, against us in every respect? Why should we talk about Marx's thought, and why should we even bother to take him seriously? I think there are two reasons, at least, why we should pay some attention to Marx. The first is simply that in this world that we all live in, the thought of Karl Marx has been extraordinarily influential. Somebody asked in a previous session to name some philosophers who have really had an impact on the world, to name some thought systems that have really resulted in changes, for better or for worse. And as soon as one asks that question, the first thinker whose name comes to mind is that of Karl Marx, and he's been extraordinarily influential, and one doesn't have to do more than read the daily paper just once to understand that. Another reason is that, and we've heard it in some other sessions here, it's been suggested that Marxist ideology has as part of its outlook a notion of social justice, which in many ways expresses notions which, if not identical with, are very close to notions presented in the gospel. That is to say, the suggestion has sometimes been made that perhaps we as Christians have something to learn about social justice, about the distribution of wealth, about caring for each other, and so on, from generally Marxist outlooks. So I think that for those two kinds of reasons, it's important in this context to take a look at the thought of Karl Marx. Now Marx is a writer that when you begin to read him, at least when you're reading the younger Marx, the early writings of Marx, his prose is very compelling. I mean, he writes in a way that reminds me a bit of the prophet Isaiah. I mean, you want to be on his side. You want to say, yes, I understand it, or I know that, and sure, I'm with you, and yes, I'm not one of the bad guys, and so on and so forth. And then, you see, you begin to measure some of the consequences of what Marx is saying, and you may just as strongly say, I don't want to have anything to do with that. What Marx is really leading me down the road to is a social economic system which has no respect for the individual. It's absolutely anathema to what I believe. Marx deplores a religion that I hold very close, and so on. Stay away, you know. In other words, Marx is a writer about whom it is very hard to be neutral. Nonetheless, my attempt in this exposition of Marx is to be neutral. I'm not going to be pro-Marx today, nor am I going to be anti-Marx today. I'm going to try to be fair to what Marx has said as a kind of invitation for you to think about this very influential, in global terms at least, very influential thinker, and resolve some of these questions on your own. I think that we can, to let you know what my biases are, even though I'm going to try to be dispassionately neutral, my biases nevertheless probably will come through, and they are that I think we can learn a great deal from Marx, but I at least don't think that we can subscribe to everything that he says, and I think there are some real flaws in his system. And perhaps in the course of my exposition, it will become clear the sorts of things that I think we can perhaps learn, as well as the sorts of errors that I think he has made. The basic position of Karl Marx is called dialectical materialism. How many have heard the term? Of those of you, now that's about half of you, or perhaps a bit less than half, that have even heard the term. I would suspect of those of you that put your hand up, if I were to say, now give me a succinct definition of dialectical materialism, you'd say, well, perhaps I could do that better on another day. So in a sense, what I'm going to be trying to do today is to just make clear what this, you know, sort of mouth-choking expression, dialectical materialism, means. Let's begin by talking about materialism, and I'll get to the dialectical business in, before I'm done. Materialism. What Marx is asserting is that all of reality is essentially material. That is matter. That means, you know, the sorts of things that tables and chairs and the stone fireplace and so on are made out of matter. What he is ruling out by saying that everything is fundamentally, basically, essentially material, what he's ruling out is any reality to be the granting of any reality to a spiritual dimension. There's no such thing as spiritual reality. Marx has a way of dealing with what we call, or what he calls religious phenomena, and he reduces them to a manifestation of material reality. Okay? Now, material reality is organized in a certain way. It works itself out in certain patterns that we can understand, that science can recognize, and it works itself out in history. That is, the organization of material reality has historical consequences, and we can understand history, past history, and future history, that is, what is going to happen, if we understand the fundamental organization of material reality. It's as though you know formula, the recipe for material reality, and if you know that recipe, then you know what you're going to get when it's all done. And so you know how history is going to go if you understand the formula or the recipe or the organizational principle of material reality. So he's a materialist. That means that material things are important, ultimately important. Our relationship to the material world is what is important, and our ability to deal with it, with the material world, is what is ultimately important. Now, I want to make clear, at the same time that I stress the materialist outlook of Marx, that Marx is in no way a materialist in the kind of crass sense that we sometimes, in ordinary language, apply the term. We might say about our neighbor an acquaintance or somebody that we've read about in Time magazine or something, he's just a materialist, by which you mean that this person is devoting all his life to the acquisition of material comforts, and you know, the good life means having three television sets and so on and so forth. Marx is not advocating that kind of excessive consumption or the acquisition of material goods. He's not a materialist in that sense. He is a materialist in the sense that he says the material goods which fill our world determine the character of our lives, and therefore we need to understand the material nature of the world in order to make possible the best kind of life. Okay, so much for what it means for Marx to be a materialist. I will, in what I'm going to say now, I think amplify that sufficiently so that it will become more clear to you. I think we can understand Marx's basic outlook in terms of three statements. Two were actually said by Marx, one was said by Lenin, but it was a statement by Lenin trying to clarify Marx, and I think that he did in this statement actually remain true to Marx's outlook. The first statement is this. This is a statement made very early by Marx commenting on another philosopher, a philosopher named Ludwig Feuerbach. This statement is called Marx's last thesis on Feuerbach. Marx says, up to now, philosophy has only tried to interpret the world. The point, however, is to change it. Up to now, philosophy has only tried to interpret the world. The point, however, is to change it. Now, what Marx is doing here is prescribing what the role of the philosopher should be. Marx is breaking radically with the philosophical tradition in this new prescription for what a philosopher ought to be. And Marx is also, and this is perhaps most important, suggesting a wholly new way of knowing, how we come to know anything, how we know about the world we live in. Now, in order to clarify what Marx means, let me take a step back and look at the history of philosophy, the traditional outlook that Marx is trying to break with. That aspect of the tradition that Marx is most violently breaking with was expressed in an allegory told in Greek antiquity by Plato. It's called the Allegory of the Cave. Perhaps some of you have heard of it or read it. In the Allegory of the Cave, Plato asks us to imagine a situation in which a group of prisoners, that is, they're bound hand and foot, seated in a cave, are looking at the wall in front of them. Projected on the wall are a number of shadows. The prisoners cannot look side to side, and therefore all they know about is what they see on the wall. Now, Plato says, this is a condition of mortal man. This is a condition of mortal man. That is, these prisoners in the story really represent the condition we live in throughout our lives. We're looking at shadows. We think that the shadows are reality. Now, in the story, a philosopher enters the scene, unties one of the prisoners, and drags him kicking and fighting out of the cave, and shows him the real world, and then brings him back. Because he's mortal, he has to go back into the cave. What he does now, this enlightened, philosophically instructed prisoner, is to say to his fellow prisoners, guess what? Everything that you believe is wrong. Let me explain the way it really is. I'll tell you these are only shadows. The shadows are cast by a fire and so on and so forth. What's really the condition of the world is outside the cave, and it's like this. But what he does not try to do, and this is what gets Marx, what he does not try to do is say, let us together throw off our binds and get out of this cave. Why should we sit down here in this rotten cave when there's fresh air outside? Okay? In other words, Marx is saying, up to now, philosophy has tried to interpret the world. The point is that we ought to change it. We ought to try to get out of the cave. Why should we tolerate things the way they are? So Marx is an activist, right? Philosophy must be activist. Philosophy is given by Marx a new kind of moral force. You've got to act in order to change the world. If you understand it, you ought to do something about it. Now, there's more to the story than this, because the question is one of how do you know what you're doing and what you're changing really is an expression of the truth. How do you know that your own personal interests or the interests of your group, your class, your community or whatever, are not biasing you in such a way so that you're going to change it to make things, you say, comfortable for you, but not really an expression of the truth. Well, that is a long and complicated question, and it's a question that one of the questions in dealing with Marx I invite you to think about, but let me say just a little bit about it, which will not be satisfactory, but which will at least, I hope, open the door. The model of knowledge, which Plato and philosophy traditionally has operated with, is theoretical knowledge. Knowledge culminates itself in theory. Now, has it ever occurred to anyone that the word theory and the word theater sound alike? Yeah, that's a different word, though. Okay, but there is a relationship. The idea of theoretical knowledge is it's the sort of knowledge that one has when one is in a theater. That is to say, it is a knowledge that you have when you are distanced, as in a theater, you're sitting distance from the stage, you're not involved in the action, and you are able to be dispassionate about it. When you watch the murder on the stage, or when you know that the murder is going to take place, you don't jump out of your seat and run up and get on the stage and stop it. You see, when you're dispassionate and distanced when you are in a theater, and the ideal of theoretical knowledge is to be dispassionate and distanced. And sometimes we say, well, that is what objective knowledge is. I can only be objective about it if I'm not involved in it. An important canon of scientific method, too, is that if you're going to observe something, you have to be careful that you're not, you know, biasing the results by getting your, you know, something about the conditions of the experiment, your observations mixed up in it. You've got to have that kind of distance. Well, Marx is saying that there's something fundamentally immoral about this theoretical gazing upon reality, and in fact, there's something unattainable about it. That the only way we ever really know anything is when we are engaged in it, with it. And so what Marx does is substitute for theoretical knowledge the idea of practical knowledge. He uses the term praxis. It can't really be translated, but it means that sort of engaged, connected expression of human concern with relationship to an object. Okay? So the point, Marx says, is to change the world. We understand the world only insofar as we are connected to it, engaged with it, and the process of our practical activity is how we come to know what the world is. So you see, knowing and changing turn out to be the same thing. Acting and knowing turn out to be the same thing. Okay? That means that you're either going to act in the right way, or you're going to act in a way which is going to retard true knowledge. And that's the problem that's before Marx. Now, you can see, too, how this notion of knowledge as praxis rather than theory is not only compatible with the moral admonition to change the world rather than simply interpret it, but is also compatible with a materialist philosophy. Okay? There's no split. In the last hour we were talking about a split between man and nature. For Marx, there is no split between man and nature. We are one with it, and the problem of understanding emerges out of the kind of action possible with something that is really a part of us. Okay? Any questions about this? Okay, second statement. Labor created man. Labor created man. I say that labor created man, we can first understand it to begin with by what it says did not create man. God did not create man. Laborers created man. Who are laborers? Well, laborers are men, humans like ourselves, and they are those who are engaged with the material world. They are not the theoreticians, they are not the intellectuals, they are not the people who are dispassionate about their condition. They are the people who are directly related to the material world and manipulating it, doing something to it, making products. And in making these products, you are making the place in which you live, and the place in which you live, in turn, has consequences for how you are able to live, and how you are able to live has consequences for your future relationship to the material world, and so it goes. And so the process of laboring is what has made man. Now, what is man? Marx looks at man in the middle of the 19th century. Industrialization is upon us. We are highly organized in social systems. We have different kinds of classes. We have capitalist classes and workers' classes, and they have certain kinds of oppositions, and there are certain kinds of struggles going on. And all of this, Marx sees, as having grown out of the history of man's labor. Who we are, which means what we're able to do, how we understand the world, what our freedoms are, what our hopes, desires, joys, and so on, what, all of those things are a consequence of the history of labor. So it's in that sense that labor has created man. That also means that man really has created himself, not by himself, but as a social, historical creature engaged with the material world. That accounts for the human condition, the history of labor. It means that man has got to be understood then in a process. We don't have the idea of man in possession of some kind of unchanging and unchangeable soul for Marx. You know, it's not, some people, and this is I think a popular interpretation, but probably not a very good biblical interpretation, but at least in the popular Western consciousness, people often take the statement in Genesis that God created man in his image to mean that we have a soul, and this soul is of a substance or a nature like God, and thus it is unchanging, eternal, as is God, you see. Okay? Now, I don't think that's a good biblical interpretation, but I think you've all heard that sort of thing. At any rate, that kind of notion Marx absolutely denies. Okay? There's nothing like this which is permanent, unchanging. Everything is malleable. Everything is the result, just as we're like a piece of clay which has been molded through the historical process of man's own labor. Now, I think if you reflect on this and put it together with the notion that the way we come to know the world is through our practical, active engagement with it, and we have a moral obligation to make it as desirable as we can. When you put those two things together, you see they really fit hand in glove and really suggest a very strong foundation for why people ought to do things, why people ought to act. I mean, we have the opportunity. We are in possession of the power to change the world in a way which is going to make it more desirable for us, and so on. The question is, do we have any assurance that it's going to ever get any better? Weren't things perhaps better in a simpler time? Wouldn't it have been just a lot nicer if we could live in a simple community of craftsmen who are dealing with the unchallenged availability of resources, where you don't have class distinctions and fighting, and so on and so forth, and is indeed you know, that sort of vision possible now as the modern world emerges? We are what we are because of the history of labor, Marx teaches. Is it that the history of labor has taken us farther and farther away from an idyllic situation, so that if you're a Marxist, you've got to be pessimistic? Indeed, Marx, in his writings, talks about the sense in which we're all in the mid-19th century, and it would still apply now, lost and alienated from our true being and isolated from our fellow man and so on. So it paints a picture in which we really are too far from our true purposes. But is there any basis for hope? Or is Marxism an essentially pessimistic outlook? Well, there is a basis for hope, and it's here where I will reflect on the other half of that term, dialectical materialism. Marx has a dialectical philosophy of history. Let me try to explain that by commenting on the remark made by Lenin, but which I think is just as well could have been made by Marx. It is, violence is a midwife of every old society pregnant with a new. Violence is the midwife of every old society pregnant with a new. Key terms: violence, midwife, society, pregnant. Begin with society. Society means simply the organization of people, some kind of systematic, largely economic organization of people. It doesn't mean natural communities, okay? But it means the structure which organizes the way we live and indicates what possibilities we have, what the possibilities are for laboring, what the possibilities are for education, what the possibilities are for, you know, Romeo marrying Juliet and so on. Pregnant, he's suggesting, obviously, that societies somehow contain within themselves their successors. That no society is going to last forever, that societies are temporary institutions, and at some point they replace themselves, and that the new society, which has replaced the old, is contained in the old society at some point in its history. Violence. I think that the term violence in Marx is unclear. Many people have taken it to be violence in the sense that probably first comes to mind. That is, guns and hand grenades and so on. Jean-Paul Sartre, writing in the preface to Frantz Fanon's book, The Wretched of the Earth, and Frantz Fanon was an African Marxist psychiatrist, says that power grows out of the barrel of a gun. You know, his interpretation of the violence which was necessary to change society. It seems to me, though, that one needn't read Marx that way. I don't think Marx is entirely clear. Barbara Deming, a Marxist sociologist, once interpreted the term violence in Marx to mean radical uncompromising action. Radical uncompromising action. And I think that perhaps gets closer to the meaning that Marx had in mind, although that, of course, would include the violence that comes out of the barrel of a gun. But it might also include the sort of nonviolent resistant techniques of somebody like Gandhi. At any rate, let's try to understand the term for our purposes here as radical uncompromising action. That is to say, that praxis, that kind of practical engaged action with material reality, which now includes the institutions made by labor, social reality, that sort of practice, which simply isn't going to yield, which isn't going to compromise, which has gotten to a point where it's this and I'm going to stand for this, or we're going to stand for this until it is realized. Okay, finally, midwife. I think we've all heard of midwives, but the way Marx uses, or the way Lenin uses the term, and the way Marx uses the term, because he also used the term midwife, I think reflects the use of the term midwife in the history of philosophy. I began talking about the, up to now, philosophy has only interpreted the world. The point, however, is to change it with a reference to Plato. It seems to me that midwife provides a reference again to Plato, or at least the one person who appears more often in Plato's dialogues than anyone else, namely Socrates, because Socrates characterized himself as a kind of midwife. Socrates wanted to change, in some sense, by awakening the society of Athens. Violence, according to Lenin's reading of Marx, is going to replace Socratic midwifery. Well, what does a midwife do? In the world of Plato and Socrates, a midwife had four functions, and it seems to me that for Marx, midwifery, that is, violence, is seen as having four functions. The first is the midwife diagnoses that the woman is indeed pregnant. It might be a false pregnancy. Marx is suggesting, or Lenin Marx is suggesting, that a show of violence in a society is an indication that that society is now ready to give birth to its successor. It's actually a diagnosis. Now, I remember, and I was thinking about it recently because it was 10 years ago, which was the last time I was at Holden Village, it was one of the longest and hottest of the long hot summers, and we were driving, planning to stop in Chicago on the way back, and listening to radio commentaries and picking up newspapers on the way, wondering indeed whether it was safe or whether the whole city was going to be in flames, coming across many analyses from a Marxist perspective which suggested that here we have now the first sign that the revolution is underway. The new society is about to be born. This violence in the streets of Chicago was seen as a sign, you see, at least from the Marxist perspective, that the old society, with its racial discrimination and so on, was going to break apart and give birth to the new society in which this sort of inequality wouldn't prevail. Okay, so the first sense in which violence is a midwife is, according to Marx, in that it's diagnosis, the readiness. Now, what does that mean, you see? Well, I mean, if you're a Marxist and violence begins to show up, well, you know, that's a good sign, you see? I mean, finally, the chains of oppression are being broken. The society itself is giving birth to its successor. The second thing a midwife is supposed to do is to, if not completely eliminate, at least lessen the pain of childbirth. And the midwife is able to do this by instructing the woman in the process of childbirth about how this goes according to nature, you see, so that you don't fight against nature's process and thus make it more painful. You understand when to bear down, not when to bear down, and so on, I guess. I'm not terribly informed about this sort of thing. But the point is that the midwife, you see, in understanding what is a natural process, helps the woman to work with nature to limit the pain. Okay? Violence, then, is really working with nature to eliminate, or at least limit, pain. What kind of pain? Well, the kind of pain which would prevail if the old society persisted longer, that is, the pain of injustice, inequality, class struggle, the pains which are part and parcel of the structure of the old society. Violence is breaking those structures down and allowing, you see, for the elimination of that kind of pain. Now that, of course, does not mean that there will not be some pain. There'll be a certain kind of pain, a pain of transition, but Marxists are willing to accept the kind of pain afflicted by the violence of transition because they see it as, in part, working toward the elimination of pain. Third, and here we'll get to the idea of dialectic. One of the functions of the midwife is to hasten the delivery, okay, to speed up the delivery. Now, you know, you don't need a midwife or a physician to have a baby. The baby's going to be born if nature works out properly, whether or not there's a midwife or a physician or anybody in attendance there. Midwife is not necessary to make the baby come. Okay? Now, violence is a midwife of history. What Marx is saying is that the new society is going to be born, whether or not you have this violent revolution, whether or not you have any midwifery. Okay? The new society is going to be born. Why? It's going to be born because history has, as I suggested before, a kind of, insofar as history is the manifestation of the laboring effects, or the effects of labor on material reality, has a formula, a recipe, a beginning, you see, which has it all charted out. And it's going to go in a certain direction. And the way it goes is that it goes through stages of opposing itself. And here's the dialectic, and here's really why you see the violent conflict. You have a given situation, whatever it might be, which limits itself, that is, expands itself to the limits of the possibility of that sort of situation, and in reaching its maximum articulation, or its maximum realization, going as far as it can go, makes clear what the limits to that principle of organization or that social structure is. That is to say, it, in order to be what it is, requires a boundary between what it is and what is its opposite. Okay? Now, a colloquial way of putting this was that this one articulation or this one statement is called a thesis or a positing. And then that which defines it and limits it and makes it what it is and which is therefore necessarily related to it is the antithesis or the opposite. Okay, the posit and the opposite, or the thesis and the antithesis. But the point is that the thesis and the antithesis need each other. You can't have a thesis unless there's an antithesis, just as you can't have light, or at least understand that light is light, unless there is darkness. Okay? Now, because of the relationship of each needing the other to be what it is, the relationship of logical reciprocity, you can, and a philosopher who influenced Marx quite a bit, namely Hegel, did say this, you can say that they are logically equivalent. Now, they are logically equivalent, but they have a very amazing relationship to each other because they need each other to be each what they are, and they negate each other. And this results in a kind of transformation of one to the other. And this is the dialectical movement. The transformation is a simultaneous preservation and negation. Preservation and negation. But when you simultaneously preserve and negate, you, in Hegel's terms, elevate. That is, you get something which encompasses both of them in a new way. Okay, so what's happened? In the old society, we have
according to Marx now, a dialectical relationship between some of the elements in the society, let's say the workers and the capitalists. In order for workers to be workers, there have to be capitalists. In order for capitalists to be capitalists, there have to be workers. But there's this kind of dialectical contradiction. And the transformation takes place, and all of a sudden we get a new society which contains both capitalism and labor, but not as capitalism and not as labor. Not with this kind of opposition, but it's taken up and transformed into something new which contains it. Okay? Now that transformation is simply one of a whole series of transformations which have got to go along according to the basic logical structure of material reality. And so you know with assurance that this conflict is going to take place, that it's going to work out, and that eventually you're going to get to that form of social organization where this kind of dialectic has completely worked itself out and you have the ultimate society where these conflicts no longer take place. Okay? Now that is going to happen. It's the basis of hope for Marx, and violence is simply a way of speeding up this inevitable dialectic of history moving toward this ultimate society. So you rejoice when there's violence because you know that the new society is near at hand. The new society is going to come anyway, but violence will speed it up. Thus, if you're a Marxist, you may want to be part of the revolution, you see. You may want to continue to foment violence. Why? In order that history will work itself out the way it's designed to, in order to allow for the emergence of the new society. Okay. Now, if any of you are the least bit skeptical, and I hope most of you are, at least that, you'll say, but sometimes revolutions just don't do that. That if you look at the history of Europe, and you look at the revolutions of the 19th century, the revolutions of 48 and so on, Communist Manifesto was written in 1848, a year of many revolutions, that this hasn't happened. You know, we don't have sort of the ideal society where there are no conflicts. But Marx has an answer to that too, because he says the fourth function of midwifing, and it was a function that the midwife did possess in Greek antiquity at least, is to take a look at the offspring and see whether or not the child is really viable. And it was the task of the midwife in Greek antiquity to take a look at the newborn, and if it was believed by the midwife, not the parents, that the newborn was not viable, then to expose it and commit it to the funeral pyre right away. Okay, the midwife did that. Well, violence, Marx says, does that too. That is to say, if after this violent upheaval and transition and so on, and the new society emerges, but yet, you see, there's still violence, there's still counter-revolution, there's still dissatisfaction. That violence is the judgment of the midwife that says, this new society really isn't viable. It's not the new society that history is waiting for, you see. This one ought to be allowed to die. This one ought to be consumed by violence. So you see, from a Marxist point of view, you really can't be against violence at all, because what it's doing is either bringing the new society or getting rid of one that shouldn't be there anyway, you see. Okay, now I ask the question, is Marxism hopeful? And the answer is yes, Marxism is hopeful, because it sees that history dialectically is leading to the best society, the best human material institution. And that institution is one where this kind of violent conflict will not arise, because there will not be this dialectical relationship between portions of the society. That is to say, it will be the classless society. And in the classless society, you don't have violence and strife, you don't have exploitation, you don't have rich and poor, you don't have inequality, you don't have injustice, and so on. There's a lot of other things you may not have too, since labor, of course, is that which has given rise to the development of history and so on. It seems that there's not much place for labor in the classless society. And if it was labor that created man and labor which has given meaning to his life all along, it's hard to imagine what a society like without labor will be like. But at any rate, Lenin, when asked about this, acknowledged that it would not be a laboring society, and this has given rise to the notion on the part of many contemporary Marxists that it will be a society in which all menial tasks are taken over by machines, and people won't have to do anything, a society of complete leisure. Okay? Also, because justice and equality and truly human, non-exploitative relationships will automatically obtain among all people, there will be no need for governmental organization, you see? And in fact, Lenin, when asked about this, said, oh yes, the running of the classless society could easily be done by my cook. And history tells us that Lenin's cook wasn't all that bright. And one rejoinder to this is that, it's going to be such a boring place that only somebody as dull as Lenin's cook would want to run it or have anything to do with it. So that you see that what Marxism leads to is history coming to an end, really coming to an end, in a classless society where there will not be strife, where there will not be change, where there will not be conflict, where it will be a society dominated by leisure and so on. What will people do? Well, you know, you do whatever you want. You may be a bricklayer by... I forget how this quote goes. Maybe some of you remember it, but it's something like you might be a bricklayer by morning and a scholar by the afternoon and a musician by the evening or something. And just do what you want. And the promise of Marxism is that you will have something like heaven here on earth. Complete freedom, complete lack of need, complete lack of struggle, utter equality, and so on and so forth. However, and here is where Marxism really raises a question, that is a paradoxical conclusion to this process which has defined man and made him what he is, you see. Because this material being who has made himself through labor, it seems to me at least, is going to feel rather ill at ease in the classless society. I mean, nothing to do. Okay, now, we've run through a lot of issues, and some were, I know, very abstract, and in order to deal with them adequately, I would have had to talk a long time about the logic of Hegel's dialectic, and I'm sure that very few of you want to learn about that. Maybe you have some questions, comments. Yeah.
Would you say that modern Russian communism is following these lines of thought?
Yeah, well, of course, the problem that a society like Russia has is how do you account for the fact that after the revolution, you see, we didn't get this.
Yeah.
And so, well, you have the continuation, according to the official line, of the revolution, and you have the dictatorship of the proletariat. That's necessary while the revolution is continuing to be worked out. The same thing in China. You have to keep the spirit of the revolution alive. You're in the midst of the revolution, even though the battles, you know, aren't going on, so that there's no communist society which claims to have attained the goals of the revolution yet. And you can raise some good questions about whether or not this is even possible. I mean, at least in suggesting that at the end of Marx's notion of history as such a utopian thing, I'm suggesting that it is not possible actually. Utopia really means no place, right? And it seems to me that's where the classless society will be, no place. Yeah.
I must have missed a turn there someplace along the line. If his assumption is that the old society gives birth to the new, why would he not say that new society in turn can give birth to another society, et cetera, et cetera? Why should it end in the classless society?
Yeah, well, because, you see, Marx has taken a look at history and said that we've gotten to a certain point now where the final transposition into the classless society is at hand. Marx really expected, you know, that these sorts of revolutions would begin in the industrialized world. It's quite inconsistent with Marx's predictions that the revolution should have taken place in a place like Russia rather than in a highly industrialized nation. Because, you see, you didn't have the same sort of class conflict there. But Marx's reading of history was that we have gone through a whole set of struggles and gotten to the point now where this basic opposition between capitalist and worker is such that the next step is going to be the class of society.
Can you just reflect whether that is, in your better considered opinion, as naive as it is of my more simple one?
Yeah, I think that, you see, what it is, Marx is deeply influenced here by Hegel's reading of history. For Hegel, in a different way, history was culminating itself too. It is a kind of apocalyptic vision. I mean, the end of history was really at hand, and the new society was.
Well, do we say that about our Christianity also, that we're always working toward it? We're spiraling instead of just cycling?
Yeah, well, one thing that that Marx has in common with Hegel, and Hegel has in common with Christianity, is that history is purposeful, aiming towards some end or goal, you see? And so you don't have a kind of eternal cycling. But the goal of Hegel, Hegel tried to identify this with the goal of Christianity, and Marx, now taking Hegel's dialectic and making it material, has this end, something which is quite different.
Well, I've heard the phrase Christian Marxism. Yeah. What is that supposed to mean?
Well, that's not taking every bit of Marx. It's looking at some notions of equality and humanism and social justice and so on, and saying that those things are compatible with some of the teachings, particularly, I think, of Jesus. But it's not, you can't really take all of Marx and make it work with Christianity. You simply can't do that. At least seems to me, yeah.
Well, yeah, at the same time, there are those who claim that you could not have had Marxism or Marx without the Christian West, without the Judeo-Christian tradition. That it is out of that stream of assumptions and worldview, including that about history, that Marx comes, and that Marxism is a kind of Christian heresy. That's been said too.
Yeah, and Marx himself really says that. I mean, Marx's reflections on what religion, what role religion had in society, suggest that now man has gotten to a point where he no longer needs these kinds of what he calls illusions. You see, Marx, and here Marx is following Feuerbach, philosopher who he did these 12 theses on. But Marx regards religion as a kind of projection of needs, you see. But now Marx is saying we have the means at hand really to take the next step, and we no longer need to be satisfied at this level. Religion was a way by which man satisfied himself at a certain level in the development of history. And was necessary for history to have gotten as far as it did. Marx regards religion as a motivator of history.
Harold, question about Marxism and socialism. It seems to me that our fear of Marxism is equaled only by our ignorance of it. And we tend to assume that Marxism is the same everywhere.
Yeah.
Chinese Marxism certainly is the same as Russian or Cuban or Allende's Chilean version. We assume, I think, in the American culture that socialism and Marxism are identical. And they have some common elements, but there is a Marxist socialism and a non-Marxist socialism. Would you distinguish a little bit between those two?
Yeah, okay, I would want to go a bit
further. And were there other socialisms around when Marxism arose?
Yeah, let me go a bit farther too and suggest that what I was talking about is Marx, and now there are a number of Marxisms, as you've just suggested, attempts to come to grips with some of the problems in Marx, attempts to take advantage of local conditions in some ways, and in the Marxist world there's a great deal of argument about whether or not Russian Marxism is really true Marxism, and Chinese Marxists tend to say that, it's not, and so on and so forth. But I think that what we have to understand as distinctive about Marxist socialism and Marxist communism is that it rests on, I think, the three principles that I've mentioned here, which have to do with an interpretation of man's relationship to history and man as an utterly self-creating material being. Now, the most complete example of radical communism that I can think of is utterly non-Marxist. That's developed in Plato's Republic. And there, man is not a material being at all. But in order to create the most just city, a kind of absolute communism is required there. So that you can have communisms and socialisms which are utterly non-Marxist, and you can have Marxisms which sort really fall short of the ideals of communism. And I think the question that somebody raised before about whether or not present-day Soviet Union was an example of the goal of Marxism, the answer is obviously not, because of the kind of abridgment of liberties and exploitation and the real preservation of class differences and all of the things that we hear about and via Solzhenitsyn and others that go on there. So I wanted to restrict myself to talking just about Marx, and I think that upon further reflection it should be clear to people that much of what we see in the so-called communist world today simply deviates from Marx.
Was there any society that actually did attain the purity of Marxism?
Oh, well, and people argue about that, sometimes it's suggested that Cuba is coming close, sometimes it's suggested that China is coming close. For a while, Western intellectuals at least believed that Stalinist Russia was coming close and so on. But my understanding is that at least the end of Marx is genuinely utopian and can never be actualized. That's my reading of Marx, and there are many.
Isn't Marxism, as you've described it, basically an outlook or an attempt to devise a system to gain control of production and distribution of material things?
Well, that's certainly part of it.
But the whole philosophy is geared towards that.
It's because it is a materialism.
Yeah.
And the status of labor, or the status of production and distribution and all of these things, is precisely what makes a society the kind of society that it is. And if you think that you can disregard that and look to some kind of religious hope. What Marx says about religion, and this is why he says religion is the opiate of the people, is that you tend to look away from the actual material effects of social economy that you live under, and look to some sort of projected idealized society.
Well, his was certainly a projected idealized society.
That's right. Yeah, in a different way, though.
And without really any basic understanding of human nature or really the production system, because he didn't understand, apparently didn't understand human nature, because people don't function the way he said they should.
You mean because you need some sort of profit motive and incentive?
Well, incentives, yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting to know. I mean, when I was in China last fall, I was interested to discover on the commune that they have built in incentives so people can accumulate some kind of private wealth. And they need that, you see, in order to keep the quota system up.
Well, then how can this is diametrically opposed to what this idea is, so how, even if this creeps in, is taking away from the overall, how can it be part of it? If this profit and incentive motive is even in there a little bit, if they're saying it still has to be there, it doesn't even seem, it negates the whole thing in my mind. It's even workable, or even a philosophy as in some guy's dream that he got published.
Yeah, the answer is that, they say, we're not all the way there yet. And so we need in part to compromise. Yeah.
Also, that incentive system in China, as I've read about it in terms of agriculture, at least food production, which is at the basis of that society right now, is within the context of a communitarian ethic that is much different from our Western ethic of individual economic achievement, where everything is based on incentives. Isn't that so?
That's right. The incentive is
a communitarian ethic for everything, and the individual incentive or the family incentive is in the context of that.
Yes, and more than that, the quota. I mean, there is a quota system. This is what we need to do in order to meet the needs of the community and to meet the needs of the people. And how much am I expected to contribute to the achievement of that quota
That's determined by a complicated formula having to do with your age and other obligations and strength and so on and so forth. And then, if it happens that you let 1,000 flowers bloom and go over that, then there's some kind of reward. And the reward is a monetary reward or a monetary credit, which allows you to acquire such things as bicycles and sewing machines and so on and so forth. But I mean, it's certainly within the context of a communitarian ethic, as you say. And there's no possibility of one person becoming wealthy, and there's no possibility of under this kind of incentive system of one exploiting another person. See, you're overachieving for the sake of the many, and there's a kind of what you might call a profit sharing sort of reward, which can only then be applied to certain kinds of basic needs, which it's hoped, you see, in the future, when the economy is stronger, everybody will be able to have. So it's sort of an economy of gradual pulling yourself up. But I still think that it is at variance with a kind of absolutely pure view of what Marx would want.